I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Roderick Griffiths joins me now. He has written a timely, often provocative, but necessary book, Who We Are, A Citizen's Manifesto. It's partly a diagnosis of our ailing identity and part prescription of what to do to revitalize ourselves in order to meet the challenges before us, whether it's climate change or caring for our aging population. Who We Are looks at what it means to be Canadian, why our country gives us so much yet asks for very little, and what needs to happen to improve our participation and build in the building of this country. It's also a thought-provoking read and invariably answers the question, who are we? Roderick Griffiths is the co-founder of the Dominion Institute, a national nonprofit organization that promotes Canadian history and civic literacy. He is a columnist with the National Post, is co-organizer of the Monk Debates, and an advisor to the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Roderick Griffiths. Good morning, Mr. Griffiths.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. You're under 40, and you write in the book that you came of age politically not in the years of Trudeau and the Constitution or even Meech Lake, rather that the first event that really affected your view of the country was the referendum in 95 over Quebec. In Quebec, I should say. I'm a little younger than you, and I was just starting high school at the time. So, but in reading the book, it seems to me that you wrote the book for people of my generation, of our generation, that don't worry about Quebec leaving the country as much as, say, previous ones.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think that the lesson of the 95 Quebec referendum was important because it showed, in effect, that despite whatever history we may think that we share in common, despite whatever institutions, government or otherwise, that we think tie the country together, there on that one evening, on that late October night, the very kind of idea of Canada was put to the test, and it passed by the very, very slimmest of votes. And I think that from my own kind of interest in creating and leading the Dominion Institute and writing this book was to really to try to set out a different set of arguments that could form the basis of a common national identity beyond simple economic necessity. I think that's the thing maybe that disappointed me most about the 95 referendum was that Federalists, those Federalists that were left in Quebec to talk about Canada, their argument to Quebecers was really little more than, you know, you better stay in Canada because you'll keep our dollar and your economy will be stronger. There was little of that, little sense of history in terms of how they spoke about the country or Quebec's place in Canada. And it was absolutely nothing about what I write in this book, you know, a shared ideal of citizenship that could bind Canadians together, you know, whether they've been in this country for 4 years, 400 years, whether they come from Quebec or anywhere else. And that's the conversation that I'm trying to kickstart with this book.
What did you make of the Harper government's decision to recognize mm-hmm. Quebec as a nation within Canada?
Well, as I write in the book, I really did think that was a move of pretty pure and unadulterated political calculation that was not in the national interest. The Quebec as Nation resolution really created a second kind of tier or category of citizenship to which you and I cannot belong, which is the notion that there is some innate Quebecois identity that needs to be recognized as a nation, not politically, but culturally, and that as at least in my case, hailing from southwestern Ontario, my ability ever to belong to that group is suspect. In fact, it's clear that I could never claim to be a Quebecois. Yet, I don't claim to be a member of you know, the nation of southwestern Ontario. Yet now, thanks to this resolution that passed through Parliament, there is a portion of the Canadian population that claims membership in a separate cultural nation. And many people, have criticized those of us who spoke out against the resolution, saying, look, this is academic, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. And I would say two things. Look at what's happened since the resolution. First, we've seen the Bloc Québécois federally and the PQ, the Separatist Party in Quebec, jump on the Quebec as Nation resolution and use it for pretty nefarious purposes. In the case of the Bloc Québécois federally, they've been using this resolution to advance the idea that Quebec should have greater autonomy in its dealings and relations with other sovereign nation states. And I think, like a lot of Canadians, I was dismayed to see quite recently the government of Quebec enter into a labor mobility agreement with the sovereign state of France that was signed and approved by our own federal government. So a resident of Quebec now can enjoy the ability to work, seek employment in France that you or I living outside of Quebec cannot enjoy. And that's another example of this creeping kind of bifurcation or dilution of Canadian citizenship. And even, I would say, worse in terms of how the resolution was subsequently exploited, the PQ have gone on and used the Quebec as Nation statement to advance, I think, some very borderline kind of xenophobic rules that they would like to see applied to newcomers or people that move into the province of Quebec, such as passing a test on kind of a cultural knowledge of Quebec before you can stand for election, before you can petition the Quebec Assembly. In other words, a kind of, I would say, a creeping ethnic nationalism that has been unleashed by the Quebec as Nation resolution at the provincial level by the PQ that is very, very un-Canadian, I think is an unfortunate byproduct of again, what was a politically opportunistic move by both not just the Conservative Party, but the Liberal Party of Canada, too, in terms of voting for the Quebec as Nation resolution.
So do you see national unity in a crisis coming up shortly, perhaps, because of this? I mean, you write in the book that climate change could be the next source of friction, or is a source of friction mm-hmm. today.
Yeah, look, I think we're coming out of what I would call a kind of a period of global and national stability that was buoyed by, as we know, an artificial expansion of credit globally, and buoyed by the growth of the Canadian economy over the last decade and a half, one of the largest economic expansions in our history. And I think that those good economic times smoothed out a lot of the bumps or worse in relations between the federal government and the provinces and between the different regions of the country. And I could see a much more difficult future ahead for Canada, a future of dealing with rapid climate change and the stresses that's going to put on our federation, both fiscal, because it's going to cost billions of dollars to adapt to the effects of a warmer planet, but also in terms of stresses between regions, and we're seeing that around the debate on the oil sands. What's good for Alberta and Saskatchewan may not necessarily be good for, urban dwellers in Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. A hotter climate, a resource kind of depleted world where things like the tar sands becomes, a golden goose that both the federal government and maybe the Alberta government are not in a position to clean up or to move against in a way that the rest of the country might like to see development slowed on the oil sands. All these things are going to cause big stresses in our federation. I think we've spent, the last decade or more in this time of economic prosperity, really not thinking through and figuring out the institutions, the values that we share in common. And we've fallen into this trap, I think, of defining Canada through our differences. And while differences are great, and I think diversity is what makes this country interesting, we've got to understand that all that diversity, all that difference is only possible because we share certain things in common, because we share values and institutions and history as a people. And it's high time that we start to reinvest in those points of commonality in order to deal with the difficult issues and events and challenges that the future holds in store.
I've been a great admirer of your work with the Dominion Institute over the years, and you've been concerned about Canadians and their sense of history. Year after year, our knowledge of history has declined. Why is it that we're less conscious? Mm-hmm. When did it begin, do you think?
Well, I think it really began I'm 38 years of age, so it probably began, as I was going through high school. We had these battles in the curriculum, which is an issue of exclusive provincial jurisdiction in Canada, whereby, schools and ministries of education, I think, dropped the ball in terms of being there to produce, citizens, as opposed to focusing on the goal of employability. And I think starting in the 1970s and continuing forward into the 80s and 90s, our entire education system was increasingly retooled around the objective of producing graduates who can go on and be productive members of the workforce. So don't get me wrong, it's great to have a job. It's important to have people graduating who can, fill needs within the workforce. But I think our schools lost sight of that older kind of humanist, civic mission of producing active and informed citizens. And as a result, history suffered. History was cut out of the curriculum. I mean, in a country as diverse and decentralized as our own, I think it's somewhat perverse that only four provinces require students to take some form of 20th century Canadian history as a dedicated course in order to graduate from high school. I mean, we rightly spend an awful lot of money subsidizing Canadian culture to try to tell our story. But the one area where we have absolute sovereignty, absolute jurisdiction, our classrooms, we've really abrogated our responsibility to ensure that future generations of young people know something about the country to which they belong.
What happens, do you think, if we become more conscious? Does it matter who our first prime minister was? Mm-hmm. If we know that it was MacDonald, will that make us want to vote for the next prime minister, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, there is, all the research shows, and I explored in some depth in the book, all research shows that civic literacy, in other words, what you know in terms of your political institutions, the responsibilities and duties of voting, of being politically kind of conscious, regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, that your quotient of civic literacy really determines your level of civic engagement. So we know that if you can get more history and civics to young people while they're in school, they will go on as adults and participate both in their communities and in national kind of civic life to a higher degree than the cohorts of fellow students who are going through the system largely unexposed to any kind of concerted focused study of Canadian history or civics. So you could say, well, that's great. People are learning more history, they're learning more civics, they're going out and voting more. And yeah, I mean, we know also from research that the amount you vote in your first election is the rate of voting in the first election is the rate you vote for each subsequent election. So, the roughly two-thirds of first-time voters who did not cast a ballot in the last federal election, we've lost them not just for that election, but every subsequent election that they have the opportunity to participate in as an adult citizen. And again, I just think that's a huge kind of civic deficit that we begin to incur as a country by not having invested in these people as young adults, not having educated them about their history, their civic responsibilities, and not getting them to the ballot box when they had that first opportunity to cast a ballot.
What about people who know their history, who are perhaps disenchanted with the system, who don't perhaps agree with the institutions that we have and would like to see them reformed?
Well, you're here. I mean, I'm all for kind of informed public opinion and debate. So my beef is not with dissenters. I think dissent is important. It's with what I call in the book civic slackers. So a generation of Canadians, my generation included, volunteering at lower rates, who are voting at lower rates, who have declining levels of civic literacy. And again, I think this is a different kind of deficit. You know, we're all too aware of financial deficits and their implications for the future of Canada. I think it's time we understand what a civic deficit could mean for Canada 10, 15, 20 years from now.
A provocative part of the book is that of your ideas on national service, that it should be mandatory.
I agree, yeah. I think there should be some form of national civic service. And here's the pitch. We know that young people are graduating from post-secondary and other education that they undertake after high school with record levels of personal debt, frankly, often takes, you know, a decade or more for them to pay off, and it really affects their quality of life as young adults. So my pitch in this book is, you know, we will provide a level of funding hitherto not seen for young people to go to university to have post-secondary education, but in turn for receiving that gift from your country to you, we want you to give 8 or 9 months of your life to your country through a form of civic service. That could be military service, but it's not exclusively military service. It could be service in your local community. It could be volunteering, you know, with a group building schools in Africa. But the purpose is to educate a generation of Canadians in what I think a lot of us have forgotten, is that, yes, citizenship is a right. It's acquired either through birth or through immigration. But it's also something that's earned. It is a lived thing. It is not simply a passport or a birth certificate. Our citizenship is something that's real, that Canadians make through the actions that they perform every day in their community, volunteering, being engaged, being civically literate. And I think there's a great opportunity here to roll out a new national program of civic service to, again, build up these reserves of civic capital that the country is going to need, just like it needs financial capital, to see itself through a difficult couple decades ahead.
There was a piece in the National Post on this past weekend on Jason Kenney, the immigration minister. It was rather glowing in its praise of him and what he set out to do. What do you make of his approach to the system?
Well, I think his approach is interesting in that he's, you know, stimulating a bit of a debate on some of these issues that I talk about in the book in terms of the citizenship test and, you know, having a better, more serious citizenship test, focusing on language skills for newcomers. But one thing I think we need to be careful about, and what I've tried to do with this book, is to take citizenship out of simply being a debate in and around immigration. I think, again, the Canadian-born, you know, like to often wag their fingers at immigrants and say, well, you should be, you know, doing X, Y, or Z. These are your responsibilities. These are the duties of becoming a Canadian citizen. Yet, you know, we're not looking at ourselves. We're not looking at the abysmal rates of voter turnout amongst the Canadian-born, the declining rates of civic literacy amongst the Canadian-born. So I hope the minister goes one step further, which is, in addition to focusing on the part of his portfolio that is immigration, focusing on, I think he has another part of his title, which is, you know, Minister for Canadian Identity, and focusing on some practical programs that get at, you know, the generation of civic slackers, the Canadian-born, to ensure that they take their citizenship with the same kind of responsibility and the same intent that many newcomers demonstrate. I think that would be a more equitable, frankly, more productive discussion.
How would you revamp the citizenship test?
Well, the test right now is really, I think, an insult to the intelligence of newcomers to this country. It's, you know, barely 20 questions long. There's a study guide called A Look at Canada, which hasn't been updated in over a decade and a half. It has questions on it, such as, you know, what are Canada's two official languages? And it lists four languages, obviously French and English, but then German and Italian. And, I mean, come on. Canada is more serious than this. I think immigrants are, frankly, who I've spoken to through our work at the Dominion Institute, are often a little confused at just how simplistic this exam is. That said, we know the exam is important. We know that immigrants take it seriously. and we know from exhaustive research that we've done at the Dominion Institute that newcomers evidence higher levels of civic literacy, having taken the exam, than not only immigrants who have not taken the exam, but in many cases, Canadian-born. That they'll know more about the laws and institutions of the country, some of the basics of Canadian history, because that's at this one moment they were asked to assume a responsibility related to Canadian citizenship, which was mastering this very basic 20-question quiz.
Hey, you're of the belief that immigrants who come to this country must speak one of the two official languages?
I don't think they must, because that would be an impossibility insofar as only about a quarter of immigrants are subject to language assessment before they're accepted as permanent residents. So those are skilled and professional workers. The rest, the majority of immigrants come to Canada under either the family ticket through family unification, which is important. Families are important. It's good to unify them. Or they come as the dependents of the primary applicant. So, as I've argued in the National Post and as I argue in this book, yes, we can ensure that within our point system we really stress the importance of language capability for those primary applicants, for those professional and skilled workers. But we also can't forget that two-thirds or more of immigrants who've received no language assessment, yet who are in the country as permanent residents and are hopefully on the path to citizenship. And that's why I think those people need, frankly, more money, more resources targeted to them to ensure that when they get to that citizenship exam, the more robust citizenship exam that I envisage, they have some basic proficiency in either French or English. And I think this is so important, especially for female newcomers, because we know all too often that if women do not have some basic proficiency in either French or English, their ability to participate in the wider community, their ability to become full and active and informed citizens is so much more difficult if you don't have some basic language proficiency in either French or English.
Back to this idea of the duty of the citizen. You write in the book about dual citizenship. How should that work? If you have a dual citizenship, who should have it, who should not have it?
Right. Well, as I argue in the book, my final kind of policy prescription is that we should allow dual citizenship for first-generation Canadians. So if you come to Canada from and you've been born abroad and you take up permanent residence and you pass the citizenship exam, you should be allowed to keep your dual citizenship because we want you to bring whatever trading and other global economic ties that you have back into Canada. We also understand that as a newcomer to Canada, your ability to enter your country of origin, to visit friends and family in your country of origin, is facilitated by having that second passport. But I think we need to say, both to the Canadian-born and to the children of first-generation immigrants, i.e. the second generation, you can and will only have Canadian citizenship. And I think that's important for two reasons. One, that it lets all newcomers know that there are some irrevocable and not unimportant consequences of their becoming Canadian citizens, and that's that their children can and will only be Canadian citizens. And it's also to say to the Canadian-born like myself, you were fortunate enough to, in the lottery of life, to be born in this country called Canada. You, by taking on dual citizenship, the country of another, the citizenship of another nation, you are somehow lessening your commitment to Canada. You're providing yourself with an escape hatch, a bolt hole to leave Canada if this country doesn't work out. Again, despite having won life's lottery and having been born in Canada. So I think those are some of the kind of simple but effective changes to our citizenship laws that we could make to ensure that Canadian citizenship retains its value, that it actually is given an expression that is commensurate with its worth.
So you've got Canadian citizenship because you were born here. You have British citizenship,
yes,
as well. Will you be renouncing that?
Well, I started that process. Unfortunately, like a lot of dual citizens, once you get into it, you realize that renouncing is if anything, a difficult process. And second, it's temporary. Once you've acquired a second citizenship, you can, in most instances, go back and reclaim that citizenship even after you renounce it. And this is why I think, in some ways, dual citizenship is something we need to take more seriously, because as a nation of very high immigration, which I support, we are going to see increasing rates of dual citizenship amongst our Canadian-born population as the children of immigrants have that opportunity to go out and acquire a second citizenship, as I did. And I think that a lot of those children, like I, will feel that that second citizenship introduced an element of doubt into their own kind of, you know, emotional relationship with Canada. That it did a, it kind of confused unnecessarily, I think, their sense of attachment and belonging to their country of birth. And that's why I think it's important we have some reform on our citizenship laws.
And finally, Rudyard, will you be running for office anytime soon?
I'm asked that question a lot. I think what I enjoy people reading this book is they say, look, I don't know where you're coming from. I don't know if you're on the right or if you're on the left. And I think if I look at the Conservative Party today in terms of citizenship issues, they're doing some things right. Also, I'd say that, you know, the Liberal Party under its new leader, Michael Ignatieff, who's talking a lot about citizenship, is also doing some things right. So I think, like a lot of Canadians, especially of my generation, looking at the political landscape, I'm holding off. I want to see parties, and I want to see political leaders that are willing to kind of set aside ideology and dogma to try to really put forward policies that are going to advance you know, the interests of all Canadians. And I think Canadian citizenship, if there ever was a policy that you know, needed and deserved a champion, this is it. There's a lot of political capital that a savvy party and a savvy leader could take off the proverbial table by backing a new, expanded, and robust vision of Canadian citizenship in this, the 21st century.
Well, let's vote for you by buying this book. Congratulations on it, Rudyard. It's thoughtful and it's an important one. You're very welcome. Continued good luck with it. The book is called Who We Are, a Citizens Manifesto. Douglas and McIntyre is its publisher. Rudyard Griffiths on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.